That never stopped us.
No. Good morning. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. It is March the 8th, and we are continuing to hear from Dr. Knorr and company. So come on up. I have been told that we're on slide 127.
You need to open public hearings.
And I have to open the public hearing. Yes, I have to do that. 5516, 5517. Dr. Knorr.
Good morning, co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction with the Oregon Department of Education. And we are here to continue our presentation on the agency's budget. Over the last 2 days, you've had an opportunity to hear about the largest portion of our budget, which is the state school fund. Many of the committee members have questions about key elements of that budget, such as the YCEP, the Youth Correction Education Program, and JDEP, for example, the Juvenile Detention Education Program. There were some questions relative to our School for the Deaf and child nutrition and many aspects of the work that we do. So today we have an opportunity to delve deeper into some of these program areas and provide you information and hopefully answer your questions. And we're hoping that by the end of today, if it's at all possible, is to get through the child nutrition programs. But of course, we will work at your pace and your interest in this regard. So we are pleased to be back, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues to share with you information about YCEP, JDEP, and other programs.
Welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe, and members of the committee. I am Sarah Drinkwater, Assistant Superintendent with the Office of Student Services at the Oregon Department of Education, and I am very pleased to be here this morning to share with you information about the programs that I supervise and oversee. The first ones I'm going to talk about are what we call YCEP and JDEP, so Youth Corrections and Juvenile Detention. The Youth Corrections Program is specifically for incarcerated youth that are aged 12 to 21 in 9 Oregon Youth Authority closed custody correctional facilities. What's interesting about this, there are 3 school districts and 4 ESDs that help provide services through contracts with ODE. All of the programs are accredited to provide credits and high school diploma to those students who are incarcerated within. There is information on the slide for you about average daily membership that we have numbers for in 2015-16. The unduplicated count is about 1,000, a little over 1,000, and the duplicated count is a little bit, almost 1,300. We have some information about demographics related to gender, with males outnumbering females by quite a bit. The average length of stay for a youth incarcerated is about 4.5 months. That's 129, 130 days. And of the funds that are allocated to YCEP and JDEP, YCEP receives the majority of it, about 3/4 of the total YCEP-JDEP budget. We do have 2 positions that are in ODE with those staff located out in the youth authority locations. Per statute, these students receive a weight of 2.0. Related to JDEP, the Juvenile Detention Program, this provides education for youth who are 12 to 18 years of age who are in detention centers as they are awaiting their cases to be heard or dispositions if they're found charged or found guilty. And their average stay is less than a month, about 24 days. So students move in and move out of those programs quite regularly. Female or males also outnumber females in the program. You can see the duplicated and unduplicated counts, 2,400 unduplicated and duplicated about almost 4,500. JDEP received.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes. Thank you.
Could you just briefly explain the difference between the ADM numbers and the population numbers, because they're in the thousands for the ADM and in the low hundreds for the other ones? I was hoping I would just be able to figure it out on my own, but second slide and I still can't. So
you're looking at the
on both pages,
right?
There's the preliminary final average daily membership, and then the actual count it sounds like, is significantly different. So I just wondered if you could explain that.
On both of those, as students and youth move in and out, some of them stay longer than others, and some of them are returnees. So in looking at the average daily membership, you get an idea. It averages out the number, but there's a lot of move in and move out. There are also the youth sometimes move facilities, and so that they come and go from different facilities and may move to one closer to their home, but may have started out in one farther away from their home.
Go ahead.
So the average is, it's still three times what it is on a one-day count. That's the part that isn't quite.
I may have to find out a little bit more information
a
little bit more clear.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, no problem.
Madam Chair, and maybe clarify it. I don't know if using the average daily membership is the right terminology. It's sort of the total number of clients throughout the biennium or throughout the year. And so really the ADM would be closer, I believe, to the 330 and 447.
Correct.
So that's the average daily membership. The others are the number of people that cycle
in and out
of the thing.
Okay.
So I think using the term ADM in that column creates an issue.
Thank you. It is the daily that was throwing me off, because I thought, well, if that's the average daily number, then how come it's four times or three times? But that is the number overall of clients, let's call them, who are served over the course of the year versus on one day there is this many. Great. Thank you.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, that is correct, but we will make sure that to correct that in
understanding the term better.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So what kind of data do we have on these kiddos? I mean, so if they're there an average of 129 days, which is almost not quite a full school year, but, I mean, are we tracking what their success rate is with, I mean, we're giving them two weights. What's that actually translating to when they come out of corrections and go, are they going back to their regular school district? Are they just out and not connected back into K-12 after they've served this time or spent this time in these kinds of facilities?
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Parrish. Students and youth transition out. Many of them return back to their school district. There is a transition plan that occurs with the school district. Some of the youth graduate and complete their high school credits while they're in, and some may also start college courses while they are there. So it's a variety. There are, in a minute, there are a couple of slides just related to the achievement on the summative statewide tests, but it's a variety, but there are transition plans that are developed for each of the youth as they transition out.
I'm glad we have these two ladies on this committee, because they keep asking questions that I was thinking, but I didn't have
to. You weren't asked.
So to complete with the JDEP program, they receive about the other quarter of the total YSEP and JDEP budget, and these students receive a weight of 1.5. So the next slide is the funding overview for this program, and the program is funded primarily through other funds, state school funds transferred from there, and is based on the number of ADMW, so the average daily membership weighted, and that helps stabilize the revenues for the programs, which is very helpful. Federal funds provide about 12% of resources from IDEA, special education funds, and neglect the delinquent. Title 1D came up yesterday related to students and youth who are associated with DHS. This is another group of students who fall under Title 1D, the neglected and delinquent federal funding. So you can also see that the 2015-17 legislatively approved budget of $18.7 million compared with the 2017-19 budget of $19.4 million, though the percentages stay about the same, 88% and then 12% of federal funds.
Representative Lively.
Co-Chair, and I'm sorry, I should have asked this earlier, but because of the age span in the one, which is up to 21, which is different than normal, but the how we apply the formula is the same even through 21?
That is correct, because youth can be served until they're 21 in public education.
Thank you.
Sorry. This slide shows the program or the test results from the OAKS assessment over a number of years up until 2013-14. And you can see with the red trajectory that students in this program score highest in reading, followed by science. Writing and math, math is the lowest score, and those are over a number of years. You can see reading has greatly increased, and then science and writing sort of have played tag with each other over time. We move to the Smarter Balanced Assessment, and this is 2 years of scores related to students who are in the YSEP program. And again, reading is the highest scoring, math is the lowest, and then science is in the middle. You might wonder about these scores. Many of these students come to the Oregon Youth Authority not having attended school very much. Maybe they don't even have any credits completed in high school, and so they are very at-risk students.
And those percentages are percentages of what?
Those who met or exceeded the criteria for the standard or Smarter Balanced Assessment, state assessment.
Okay. So it's a percentage that achieved where they ought to be. Where they ought to be at that grade level would be 100%, and so they're a third of them making it, or a fourth, or or 12th.
Co-Chair Monroe, that is correct.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
So, in summary related to the YSEP and JDEP programs, there are no reductions from current service level. The governor's budget for 2017-19 maintains the current service level to ensure compliance with state maintenance of effort requirements. That term came up yesterday, and the state is required to maintain the same resource amount and services for students from 1 year to the next, just as local education agencies, school districts also have a maintenance of effort related to special education. And there are no additional investments.
Representative Hernandez.
Question regarding, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question regarding that. Maintenance of effort. Has there been a point where you had to keep current service level while enrollment was down?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Hernandez, I think you're asking, has there ever been a year where there was difficulty with the state maintaining maintenance of effort?
Sure.
Okay. and actually, before I was here, at the with the office in 2011, and that was a year where there was very much difficulty with the budget and reductions were made. There was a difficulty noticed related to the state maintenance of effort, and around May or so of that year, we came back to the legislature and requested $13 million in order to meet the state maintenance of effort, and that was approved, and so it was maintained for 2011.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So I kind of want to go back to the outcome piece. You know, and I think that triggered it for me was the no additional investments. But I feel like there's a gap in this population, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking of a particular child who recently came out of one of these programs. I don't know which alphabet soup it was, but it's basically inside a program for about 2.5 years, did not come out with a high school diploma, to my knowledge. It turned 18, not, I don't believe, participating in a K-12 school setting right now, and not getting connected to higher ed. And so I feel like there's this window where these kids, if they kind of are aging out and we didn't get them through the system, they're now just out there. But some of these kids are also still connected to like a parole or probation type situation. So are we connected to that person who's in the justice system who is still maybe has supervision of these kids as they've come out to really be trying to track outcomes for them? Because I but I can think of one student in particular who I think we missed. And
Co-chairs Monroe and Representative Parrish, and you bring up a situation that does occur, and you the scenario that you mentioned about a student who is 18 who may be making a decision for him or herself separate from perhaps what his or her parent may want. All of those connections with parole and or transitioning back to a school district to complete a high school program are in place. Oregon Youth Authority also has access to online GED programs, and if students look like they may perhaps be more interested in doing that kind of thing, they're able to complete that when they're in the Youth Authority as well. But with there could be instances where a student as an adult makes some decisions and loses connection, but there are staff on in school districts and with the Youth Authority who try to connect and keep those students enrolled or trying to finish their high school diploma. As I mentioned before, they are at risk and disconnected youth often from the beginning, and trying to establish strong relationships with them.
Go ahead.
Maybe this isn't a question for you. Maybe we need to ask somebody from like the Justice Department, but it would seem to me, because this particular student was released at 17, just turned 18 last month. It's been out for a few months. And completion of education was not a condition of probation so the question I have is, are we missing the boat in having even a soft requirement for these kids to say, we're going to, as part of your supervision, you have to actually get something. I mean, I don't care if it's a GED or if it's a high school diploma, but you have to get something that moves you on to the next stage in your life. And I feel like if we're not having that requirement for these kiddos, like they can turn 18 and they're not going to do it, but they're still on supervision, even if we come back around and say with these youth, that's a soft condition. You're not going to pop back into prison because you didn't get your GED. But if there's sort of that threat there of if you got a completion, maybe we'll actually see them do it.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish, that's a good question, and we will connect with OYA and find out some of the parameters around the releases or parole or recommendations or requirements and get back with you.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Senator Roblin, please.
Yeah, and I guess I want to talk to maintenance of effort because Representative Hernandez's question. The state has that requirement, but each individual district has that requirement as well. And so in that same time period, when I happened to be co-speaker, when we were cutting $3.5 billion, it was very difficult for the state, but it was really difficult for especially declining enrollment schools, because mm-hmm. you might decline in enrollment, which cuts into your amount of money. It's held over for a year or so, but you not necessarily declined in special needs students. And so figuring out how to make sure you met that requirement at the district level gets really complicated every year for people, because it's based on the amount of money you spend, not necessarily on the services, which goes back to what Representative Parrish has asked a lot about. So once you've implemented a program and started doing some things and spending that money, it's really hard to ever go backwards. You can't go backwards. I mean, basically, you're going to keep doing it. You can, if you lose a student, take the amount you would have been kind of shuffle, but even that's difficult to do. So it is a complex problem, and for local school districts, just as complex as it is at the state level.
Thank you. So we will move on to Oregon School for the Deaf, and we will be joined by Dr. Sharla Jones, who is the director of Oregon School for the Deaf. And if you can introduce yourself for the record.
Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Charlotte Jones, the director at Oregon School for the Deaf.
So, Oregon School for the Deaf is a comprehensive program, K-21, so kindergarten through age 21, and it is accredited by two entities, Advanced Ed and the Conference of Educational Administrators of Schools and Programs for the Deaf. And its mission is to provide a comprehensive program for its students to meet the unique needs of deaf and hard of hearing students using through American Sign Language as well as English mode of instruction for written English. And this helps students to assure strong academic achievement and be more successful in their post-secondary opportunities. And Oregon School for the Deaf provides services for both students who attend just during the day and for those who reside on campus during the week. Currently, based on numbers from December 2016, OSD currently served 121 students. 58 of them were day students and 63 residential students. And if you've been to the campus, you know that it's about a 40-acre campus here in Salem. So this is a bit more information about student demographics related to the numbers from December 2016. And if you take a look at the pie chart, you'll see that the teenage youth, so high schoolers in the adult transition program, are the majority of the students, so the older students, or teenagers, I guess, followed by middle school, and the lowest enrollment is in elementary. The gender differentiation, males are about 62% and females about 38% as of December 2016. And students come from 13 counties. There have been students who've come from more counties, but in this count on December 2016, those were the counties where the students were from.
Representative Lively has a question. No,
thanks.
Lively does not have.
I looked like I had a question, but I haven't got there yet.
You had that look.
I'm working on it.
Okay.
Students are referred to Oregon School for the Deaf by their home school district. However, parents do call and inquire about Oregon School for the Deaf on their own, but all of the referral discussions and decisions come through their home school district.
You serve only a small minority of the total hearing impaired, right? Maybe 10% or something like that?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, yes, it is a small percentage, and I was going to describe sort of the reasons why the referrals for are made to OSD and why the largest number of students that are served are high school and the transition program.
Yeah, and the relationship between students that are served at School for the Deaf and those that are mainstreamed back in their local school district.
So students are referred after a period of time when they typically have not been very successful in their school general or residential or resident school where they live. And many students matriculate through elementary school and partial way through middle school and then are referred to Oregon School for the Deaf. So they arrive at the School for the Deaf already deficit in many skills, mostly in their language acquisition. They are not proficient signers at all, and so really have no mode of communication with their peers or with their families. So that relates to the smaller number that is served at the School for the Deaf. Certainly there are elementary age students who are referred earlier on and then matriculate. They could complete their educational career at the School for the Deaf, or they may transition back to their home district when they're a middle schooler with, you know, very good, strong sign language skills.
Senator Roblin has a question.
Do you have statistics on how many of the students at the school are multiply handicapped? So not just because they are deaf, but that they also may be blind, they also may be have other intellectual impairments. So is that part of the reason that they end up there as well, because it becomes harder and harder for school districts to deal with it?
Senator, co-chair, Senator Monroe and Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, yes, we have that information. We can get that specific breakdown for you, and it is true that many of the students do have more than one disability, have, in addition to being deaf or hard of hearing, have other disabilities as well.
Representative Lively.
Thank you. You asked part of the question. I appreciate it. But I'm trying to understand more of this, the decision about being made whether they end up at this school or stay in their home, especially in the younger years. I'm not familiar with what the local districts can provide for them, but is the decision ultimately a family decision? Or where does that ultimately get made? Because I'm concerned, since there's a larger number than what's there, I'm concerned about how that transition or how they get access to more intense education.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner and Representative Lively. It is not solely a parent decision. It would be an IEP team decision.
Okay.
And I would ask Dr. Jones if she wanted to add anything to that.
Thank you, if I may. It is an IEP decision, and as it's a careful decision. We want the students to be able to be successful no matter where they're schooled. Oregon School for the Deaf has a very unique situation where we have many deaf adults as the teachers, and the students, as they reach middle school, have an identity awakening, and they understand themselves a little bit better and can advocate for themselves. And so we have a lot of people coming at that time in their life for their education career.
Yeah. Go ahead.
One more. So there, what you mentioned, you talked about the potential gap, though, when they arrive there. So I guess I'm trying to understand if there's that gap, and they arrive not until middle school age in that. So how successful are you then, I guess, making that up in the amount of time we have left to provide them their education?
Representative Lively, we try our very best, and we do play catch up. And so the transition program from that 18 to 21 years old, we intensify our efforts. And so transition is very important at Oregon School for the Deaf.
Yeah.
I know in the past, you know, we've looked, this committee has looked at the test scores and results, and they're very low compared to the general population. What we're hearing today helps explain that.
Yeah.
You know, these these are not just hearing impaired. These are students that basically have failed in their local school. When I was a high school teacher, I had hearing impaired students in my class that did very well, were very successful. What we're talking about is basically the dropout types from the normal school district that were not having success, and so they go to the school for the deaf, so that it skews the overall test scores from the school for the deaf, which I'm sure we're going to see in a little bit.
So I'll just add something else unique about the demographics of these students. Also involves their families, that many of the students who are at the school for the deaf's parents or family members, over 90% of them do not sign. And so these students, children, as they grow, are growing up in a household that doesn't have a mode of communication between parent and child. And so that also impacts the situation during breaks, summer times, and things like that. And so it's different than other disabilities where a student may be blind or have a physical disability, but they have a means of communication and a language with their caregivers.
That's kind of hard for me to believe, having been a parent and a grandparent. It seems to me that if I had a hearing impaired child, I would learn how to sign so I could communicate with that child. And you're saying 90% of them don't. That is troubling.
Co-Chair Monroe, that is correct, over 90%.
Senator Roland.
And you have foster kids too, right?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner. Yes, we do.
I would learn.
And so a lot of those foster kids have gone to different homes. And again, they don't necessarily have the skills to talk with the kids. So,
yes.
I mean, that's another part of that group. I don't know what percentage are foster kids, but I knew there are some.
Yeah. So I'll move on. I talked about the counties where students come from who attend School for the Deaf. The black dots indicate the current counties from December 2016, and all the purple denotes all of the different counties that students have come from at different times. So a review of the budget. And you can see on the left-hand side the legislatively approved budget from 15-17. And the majority, if looking at it, general fund followed by other funds and then a little bit of federal funds. The other funds, the blue, looks larger than it does in the pie chart to the right related to current service level. And that is mostly due to the one-time other funds that were utilized. You remember the boiler and the HVAC system that were recently completed. And so the change in the two pie charts is mainly associated with that. The reduction in FTE is associated with three limited duration positions. Two were literacy lab assistants in the school, and then another is a reconciliation that will be taken care of. So as you saw in the pie charts, OSD is mainly funded primarily with general fund. The FTE that you saw on that page, 75.77 total FTE, with the majority of it focused on direct student teaching and services, with some for administration and physical plant operations. I mentioned about the 40-acre campus. So the target for 2017-19 with the current service level budget is targeted for classroom, residential, medical, and nutritional services. There's, of course, meals are provided for the residential students. There is nursing and health services available for during the day and through the night, and so those kinds of things. I did mention on the previous slide about the change in the other funds category, and in 2009, OSD was given set-aside funding from the sale of the Oregon School for the Blind to provide funding for the deferred maintenance, and the final balance from that funding was expended, the majority of it going to the boiler, replacement of the HVAC boiler system, which I know was very well received by students and staff at the school. So to give a little bit more information about services and programs for the students, it's a complete language immersion model with ASL and written English. As Sharla mentioned, much of the instruction is by certified teachers of the deaf who are deaf themselves. There are transition counselors that we coordinate with vocational rehabilitation that help with that intensive transition program as students move out to either college or career.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me see. Oh, maybe this is the page you're about to go on. So two quick questions. As an immersion, and this is a serious question, would you take a kid who is not deaf who wanted to do a dual immersion like we do in other language immersion programs? Or has that ever come up?
Smith-Warner, I'll defer to Sharla Jones to talk about the immersion related to the two languages.
To attend Oregon School for the Deaf, I'm sorry, Representative Smith-Warner, you have to have a code 20 on your IEP, which means you are eligible for special education being deaf or hard of hearing. Mm. The requirement is actually quite low. I wear hearing aids myself, and I could probably be eligible to attend Oregon School for the Deaf. So the level of hearing loss is not solely the issue. You must have need for the school. Mm. We have had local high school ASL students come and take an elective class at Oregon School for the Deaf as a partnership. We've made some really good strides in partnering with the local high schools, the ASL students. So they've come over and we've gone over. We have a video production CTE program, and so they've participated in that. So the very little bit that you've mentioned, that sharing of resource like that, but we do not have hearing students attend Oregon School for the Deaf.
Okay, follow up.
Go ahead.
Just because I know I know some folks who are involved with at Western. There's a pretty active program there, and do they do any work with the school? I would assume. Or
they have a new teacher for the deaf credential, a master's degree, and we have their interns. They're doing their student teaching at Oregon School for the Deaf.
That's good news.
Yes.
And then one final follow-up, and it's actually about the next slide, I think. Yes, 142. So the literacy lab with reading specialists and two aides. So the aides are not going to be there though this year. That was what I understood of the FTE reduction number. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, that is correct. Those positions were a limited duration, and we're looking at ways that we might be able to continue those services in a different manner in 17-19.
Thank you.
So we moved on to this slide, and the teachers who are employed at the School for the Deaf also follow SB 290 related to evaluation. I mentioned our partnership with vocational rehabilitation and a strong CTE programming. Sharla just mentioned about the video lab. I want to draw your attention to this particular picture of a basketball game, and Oregon School for the Deaf's main color, purple and gold. And students at OSD have the opportunity to participate in organized sports through OSAA, high school volleyball, football, high school and middle school students, and basketball. And this is a picture from the Western States Basketball Classic 2017, where the boys team won the classic, and OSD had not won in 27 years, I believe. And schools for the deaf who participate are Oregon, Washington, Arizona, British Columbia, and Utah. And I understand that the girls' team came in third. So there was a lot of excitement in January. So
do they also have a running program for track or cross country?
Co-Chair Monroe, yes, they do.
I was thinking they did, and that's a good thing.
And some of us appreciate the purple and gold. I just want to make sure. But there are a group of us who really do appreciate that. Secondarily, when we closed the school for the blind, you took some of those students to your. Did they have to have some hearing impairment as well to be brought over? Okay. So are there still some of those students in the program? There. Okay. Thank you. I just.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, when we Senator Roblin, when we get to the regional programs, will be and the Beavis Fund. I'll talk a little bit about the remaining students. So some of the other additional programs there is after school homework support for students, and this is very important. OSD is their evening home as well, and so they need support and encouragement related to homework, and the tutors all. Use American Sign Language in working with the students. Some of the transition opportunities that the older youth can get involved in, auto body, senior citizen home, working at the library, local retail stores. Here's some information related to graduation over the past 4 years for students at Oregon School for the Deaf. And it is very encouraging and in information about the types of diplomas and graduation. As you know, regular and modified diplomas are considered substantially similar, and the modified diploma is now being counted in Oregon's graduation rate. So if you look at 2014-15 and 15-16, you can see over 75%, 80% have graduated with a regular or a modified diploma and are able to go on to college, apply for federal financial aid, et cetera. And you have seen the extended diploma at least drop off for these years on the slide. To give some information about those students who earn a certificate, sometimes there are students who arrive from other countries. They might come from Nepal, be 19 years old, and the staff work as hard as they can in trying to help that student gain some skills and transition into adult life. There are some students who come to OSD as high school students with no high school credit. So there are a few then who would receive the certificate. So here we get into some scores, and these scores are individual. They represent a student from 1 year to the next and his or her individual growth. And so the Northwest Evaluation Association assessment has three subtests that Oregon School for the Deaf uses: language usage, mathematics, and reading achievement. And so along the bottom are scores from 2014, or 13-14, 14-15, and 15-16. The achievement gain that you see on the slide is actually the achievement gain from 14-15 to 15-16. And if you correspond that with the bars up above, you can see the increase in scores over the last 3 years. So it's a student would have to have one score in this subtest in 13-14 and 14-15 to be in that group, or 14-15 and 15-16.
Do you track graduates on into life at age 30, 40? To see how they're functioning as citizens of our country and our state?
Co-Chair Monroe and Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, I will let Charlotte answer that.
Senator Monroe, we have a very active alumni association, OSDAA, and they do a very good job of making sure they're networking together as a group of members of the deaf community. And so they have a Facebook page. We get to visit and talk to each other. They have reunions quite regularly on our campus. We're quite a hub for the deaf community in general.
Yeah. Good, thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Do we have data that cross-compares children who are attending Oregon School for the Deaf compared to deaf students who are in other K-12 settings? And are we looking at their test scores? Are we looking at graduation rates amongst that population to sort of look at efficacy of the program compared to what's being offered in a traditional public school setting?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish. We can compare the statewide summative assessment test scores for students who are hearing or are hard of hearing or deaf. And based on the information that I described, how a student is referred to Oregon School for the Deaf, the comparison of those scores of students who are being successful in their homeschool or mainstreamed is very substantially different. And so in looking at individual student growth, we do have that information and could gather that for you. This is specific individual student growth, but they also take the statewide assessment. So this is language usage. This is mathematics, and again, I'll give you a minute to take a look at that. The dark purple on the top is the scores from 15-16 compared with students who had scores in that math area in 14-15. And then reading achievement. Again, you can see the number of students, the older grades, middle school and high school, there are more students than in elementary. We had to have a matched student who had a test score in 2 years in order to include them.
Madam Co-Chair.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that was what I'm trying to make sure that I'm tracking on this. The idea is that it's the same or similar kids in each of the years, even though the number of students can be wildly different?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, yes. In order to see, I'll use examples of 14-15 to 15-16, and in order for a student's score to be in that comparison, the elementary, it says a growth of 3.8, a student would have to have a score in reading achievement in 14-15 and in 15-16 for his or her growth to be included in the overall total growth.
Because like in the middle school, you've got 7 kids in 2013-14, 23 in 14-15, and then still 23. So I guess you're only really tracking that chunk who you had all the way through. Okay.
So I'll move on to the governor's recommended budget. And there are no reductions in the general fund from current service level. The governor's budget does maintain the current service level of funding to ensure compliance with state maintenance of effort requirements. The other funds decreased, as I mentioned, due to the use of the one-time revenue, the $2.3 million from the sale of the School for the Blind and surplus property. There is an investment policy option package 109 that is in the governor's budget, capital improvement for Oregon School for the Deaf, and it relates to the sale of Q bonds for about $9.5 million or general obligation bonds for capital improvements and other deferred maintenance. The next slide goes into this a little bit in more detail.
Can you describe that deferred maintenance? We took care of the boiler. What are you looking at, roofs, or what is it?
This slide should answer that question. And back in 2012, there was a full campus assessment completed, and projects were prioritized with critical projects, of course, at the top of the list. The boiler and some other critical projects have been completed. This is the remainder of the list that were still highly needed, but were not as critical as some other. And you can see them, roof replacements, window replacements, insulation, etc. And interestingly enough, given the weather that we have had this winter and fall with all of the rain, there are roof leaks as we speak that are just being patched. Another leak is found, and it continues to be patched. So the 10-year capital need plan, looking at $22.9 million, and we have drawn out for you what would be completed in different years from 2017 up through 2027, so a 10-year plan.
Yeah, it's hard to fix a roof when it's raining. And of course,
it is.
When it stops raining, you don't need to. Sorry.
So are we taking...
Senator Roven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we taking care of the grounds? I mean, this is a fairly large place, and I know that for a while, trails and all the kinds of things were not in great shape. So are we... Is that part of this stuff, too, when it talks about ADA compliance and...
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin. Yes, that is true. There are also within the year-to-year maintenance, general maintenance plan, some of those ADA kinds of things or structural things just on the grounds are taken care of.
Okay.
So this is a transition point.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, thank you for indulging us as we transition and shift presenters here. We want to make sure that you're hearing from the experts in the department that know these programs really well. The next segment of our presentation moves into the K-12 grant and aid programs. You just heard actually about the state school fund program still, because these three programs that you just learned about or heard about are part of the carve-out of the state school fund. So as we move into grant and aid programs, this is really the second largest portion of the K-12 agency budget that equals $1.6 billion in total funds. And these funds are delivered and serviced through contracts, grants that are awarded based on competitive and other priorities, partnerships that we engage with, with community partners, community-based organizations, nonprofits, and sometimes philanthropic organizations to make sure that we collaboratively provide services to students in our schools and classrooms and leverage other resources that we can bring into the process. So this slide represents the span of these programs. Sarah is going to cover special education programs and child nutrition. Don Huckabee, our assistant superintendent for teaching, learning, and assessment, and myself and Sarah will cover the other programs, which is STEM and CTE, educator effectiveness, closing the achievement gap, and student success grants. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Sarah to talk about the special education programs.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask of you and your presenters, if possible, when you are talking about these folks, because there is such a significant federal funds element to this, can you try to point out when it's matching so that when any changes, because there's some of it is just strain federal, but any of it that's matching in particular. So if we were to cut it in one point, whether that would impact the amount of federal funds, that would be very helpful as
Absolutely.
We go through.
Absolutely.
Senator Roblin.
And along that same line, any thoughts you might have on loss of federal funds or any, if we've got any, if we look like some of them are going away, it'd be nice to know, because this is heavy federal funding.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So just so I'm clear, these are not part of the carve-out. These are additional funds over the state school fund. Mm-hmm. So when I asked the question before about looking at the totals, funds that are going to districts, then I wasn't aware of this substantial amount of funds, and so I'd like that to be part of the picture when we look at what we spend in total in each one of the districts for funding.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Lively, I would say the majority of them are not part of the carve-out. There may be one or two, as we get into the student success and the closing the achievement gap funds, those are a carve-out, but they become other funds. But they're different in the sense that it's a grant and aid package rather than direct allocation or appropriation to a program. So we will draw these distinctions. Indicate whether there is any risk to these funds at the federal level. We will also indicate whether there are some matching requirements by the state and school districts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So as Dr. Knorr indicated, I will be focusing on the special ed programs and child nutrition programs. So those are two at the top, and they equal about $973 million. So Oregon special education programs are designed to supplement, and that's an important word, to supplement the general education students, general education services, excuse me, for students with disabilities. And it's to help ensure that they benefit from and progress in their educational services. Individual programs are developed by an IEP team, which includes the parent. So the six major programs in special education are early intervention, early childhood special ed, fondly known as EIECSE, regional programs, hospital, long-term care and treatment, the BEVIS Fund, which is Blind and Visually Impaired Student Fund, and then federal special education funds that come through IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So ODE staff supports schools and provides oversight to districts, education service districts, and local providers. And we administer contracts, monitor performance, do technical assistance, collect and report required data. So this is an overview of grant and aid for special education with the 2017-19 current service level. To just give you a little bit of perspective about numbers, in 2015-16, the number of eligible special education students was 76,820. And so that's about 13% of the total public school enrollment. For early intervention, early childhood, the number of young preschoolers receiving services was 11,733. So I just wanted to give you that context. So I mentioned all of the six major programs, and this table outlines for you the amount in general fund, other funds, or federal funds. And I'll draw your attention to the federal fund column, which is the most at $327 million, with federal IDEA being the largest contributor to that. And then the general fund of $218 million, with early intervention, early childhood, special education receiving the most of that. Other sources of funding for special education, some have been discussed earlier in our presentation. The high-cost disabilities account that Brian Reeder described yesterday, $70 million per biennium. The state school fund double weight, currently estimated at about $953 million for 15-17. He also discussed the 11% cap waiver. And that is, if districts exceed the 11% cap, there is a mechanism, a waiver, a process for gaining additional monies for those students who are over the 11% cap. In addition, about $2 million are support from support the Response to Intervention Program from federal IDEA funds. So I'll go in depth a little bit more with early intervention, early childhood special education. Early childhood special education is federally mandated, and early intervention 0-2 is state mandated in Oregon revised statute. So infants and toddlers are served, as well as preschoolers, birth to school age. The hope is to address disabilities or developmental delays through early intervention to increase school readiness and success as the child transitions into kindergarten. The programs also provide resources for families. So eight regional ESDs and one school district, David Douglas School District, provide these services through contracts with ODE. Again, staff administer contracts, help monitor, provide technical assistance, and collect data. What's interesting to know about EIECSE caseload, it has grown since the 1990s. And as I mentioned before, in 2015, 11,733 children were served. This program has grown over time, but funding has not kept up with cost. As a result, service levels to children and families have declined. The annual funding allocation since 2007 has grown 6.5%, but the average teacher compensation has grown 22.4% during the same time. So with increasing number of children requiring higher services, we see a decline in services. Right now, our projections for caseload in 2015-17 is expected to exceed that by about 680 cases.
Representative Lively.
Mr. Co-Chair, and I apologize because another committee I'm on, we're talking about these same issues, so I forget where we've talked about it. But so, and I certainly understand that we have far more cases than we have ability to serve them. But so is the requirement that all children be served a federal requirement, or is that a state? Because part of the issue is here, we're required, though the funds haven't grown, if the number of students continues to grow, yeah, we have limited funds, then the services we provide gets to be further diminished. But I'm not clear on whose requirement that is.
Co-chairs Smith-Warner and Monroe, Representative Lively, the early childhood special education, which is like the 3-to-school age mm-hmm. group, is federally mandated. The 0-to-2 is state. And that was on the...
And so,
previous slide.
Go ahead.
So in both cases, though, our guidance is all children that qualify will be served.
Representative Lively, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
I will also add, in special education, you cannot hold a wait list
right.
if a student is made eligible.
Yeah, thank you.
Child. So related to the 17-19 current service level budget that includes $7.1 million in general fund for an assumed caseload, growth of 5.2% in early intervention, the little ones,
Madam
and 1.5%.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's I'm glad you got through that sentence because that's what I was going to ask about. So given that the projections for 2015 to 17 have been exceeded, did you then work from that new number to make your projections for the next biennium?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, the projections take into account more than just the previous year. It's looking at a wider time span, but it does look at specific periods of time in a year. I believe it's March, but it's not just from 1 year to the next. It's looking at it a little bit more historically as well.
Okay.
So this graph depicts the early intervention and early childhood special ed caseload growth over 10 years. The red is early intervention and the blue is early childhood. So you can see we're bumping up against 12,000 little ones. This next slide depicts services as a percentage of service level. The programs, early intervention and early childhood special ed, take a look at the level of service a child needs, whether it be low, medium, or high. And so as the caseload increases, but the funding doesn't, services get thinner, I guess, is a good way to explain it. And so the percentage of children receiving the service level standard for their need is declining. So I'll move on to regional programs. There's a table up at the top of the slide that depicts for you the general fund and federal funds that support the regional program. The regional program serves about 8,700 students who have low incidence disabilities. And people often wonder, what does a low incidence disability mean? It means those disabilities that don't happen in the population very often. And those are hearing impairments, vision impairments, traumatic brain injury, deaf blindness, orthopedic impairments, and autism. And we serve students birth to 21 through the regional program. There are 8 regional contractors and a school district, Portland Public School, who provide these specialized services to districts. And ODE staff work alongside a regional management team in statewide coordination of these services. So what the regional program assists with are eligibility evaluations and decisions about IEP services, working with a district about training staff or IEP team consultation. It could be child-specific consultation about augmentative communication devices a student may need. As I mentioned, there were about almost 8,700 students served on December 1, 2016 count. The highest category of disability receiving services in the regional programs are students with autism.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this exclude the kids who are at the School for the Deaf? I would assume.
Co-Chair Smith.
Not really.
Yes, it does.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So I'll move on to hospital and education programs. Again, the table up at the top depicts for you the different funding areas that support this program: general fund, other funds, which are state school funds, and federal funds.
Representative Hernandez.
Sorry, can we, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can we go to the previous slide? If a school district like mine, who sometimes has issues of maintenance of effort, receives this funding, does that increase that level of service, current service?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Senator Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner and Representative Hernandez. Maintenance of effort is also calculated for educational service districts who provide services as well. So it doesn't double count against a district or for an ESD. It's taken into account appropriately on both sides.
Go ahead.
Maybe I didn't
okay.
Totally understand your response. So for example, if my school district were to apply to one of these grants and they receive those resources, does that increase the maintenance of effort for my school district to, if they don't receive that grant in the next mm-hmm. year, that they have to continue to expend that much?
Okay, Representative Hernandez, I think I understand your question. Students who receive support through the regional programs may also be receiving services in their home district. So the funding counts the 8,600, 8,700 students in some of the funding. They're already accounted for, and they can access those regional programs. If they want something in addition for a student, they would pay the ESD for more services. So the regional ESD is the ESDs are counting the federal dollars and state dollars they're getting for their maintenance of effort and the district. But the student numbers are counted in for the grant. The district doesn't apply for a separate grant to the regional program.
Okay, thank you.
It doesn't increase the district's obligation.
Correct.
So do we ever bring up maintenance of effort with the federal government?
Can you repeat the question?
Do we ever ask the federal government to continue their funding levels and maintenance of effort when they are dealing with our special education needs?
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, except for Senator Roblin, no, we do not ask.
I'm just
that.
Shocked by that.
Okay, hospital. Back to a hospital education program. So this program is also established in revised statute, and it provides educational services to students who are in state or private hospitals, and they're specific state and private hospitals. So these are students who have long-term medical needs and are they're very acute and need to be in a hospital. They may have a long-term injury or a chronic disease requiring frequent and long-term hospitalization. The contracts are with Dornbecker Children's Hospital, Legacy Emanuel, Shriners for Children in Willamette Falls, and then the two state hospitals, Salem and Junction City. So we contract with ESDs and collaborate with the local hospital facilities to provide instruction when the students are hospitalized and able to participate in education.
So these students would be funded by that special up to $30,000 or in excess of $30,000 cost type program that we have. What is it, $70 million, something like that?
Co-chair Monroe, no, this is separate. You were talking about the high cost disability fund.
High cost disability.
This is separate for children who are staying in a hospital, and so these educational services for them, and they're counted through that. They're not counted for the high cost disability. We provide the services for them with the funding provided here through the hospital program.
Okay, Senator Roseman.
Individual student at an individual school district gets a really difficult illness to deal with, ends up at OHSU. The district has a responsibility for a while. If that student stays there a long time, is this what takes over from that perspective? Because the materials are still coming from the school generally.
Co-chairs, Senator Roblin, that would be correct. Because if it's a short-term stay, there would be difficulty in sort of getting the services, educational services, started. And so the facilities and the hospital program and the school district all collaborate together.
Okay.
Represent Parrish.
Thanks. The hospitals you listed sounded all kind of in the metro area. Do the hospitals like Rogue Valley, for example, not take kids long term or do we ship them all up to OHSU if they're suffering something that's more, you know, acute and long lasting?
Co-chairs and Representative Parrish, that is correct. That's not these hospitals have the children's unit. I wouldn't be able to say that there isn't a hospital somewhere else where a student might be staying long term and something may be developed with the school district, but in terms of this particular program.
All right.
So the majority of students are served with this program are students with disabilities, but I will make the distinction. Some of them are special education eligible with an IEP and others are disabled with a 504 plan if the issue is a chronic medical condition. So services occur for about 1,900 students annually.
1,900, okay. That was going to be my question.
So I'll move on to long-term care and treatment. And this is a program that receives general funds, other funds, which are state school funds and federal funds, the total of 44.8 in the current service level governor's budget. So this program is also established in revised statute, and it's providing educational services for children who are placed by the Department of Human Services or Oregon Youth Authority. And these are students who have mental health and behavioral therapeutic needs. So it's a protected educational environment for them so that they can take advantage of a total therapeutic and treatment plan. We have contracts with 27 districts and ESDs to administer the program to 40 sites statewide. And about almost 1,900 students are served annually, and their length of stay is about 4.5 months.
Representative Lightwood.
So we keep using the term students, so I assume the definition of students is the same here, up to 21.
Representative Lively, yes, that is correct. So approximately 49% are students identified with a disability.
Senator Roblin.
So you have a number of groups that you're contracting out with. Are some of those private, or are they all? Does the money all go to public agencies, and then they might subcontract to private groups?
Senator Roblin, I'm not exactly sure. I don't want to misspeak, so we will double check on if it's what the answer is.
Okay, thank you.
I will bring to your attention that in 2015-17, the legislature passed a budget note related to this program, which defined a minimum staffing level as one teacher and two assistants. And this model cannot be sustained. And so we're looking at sustaining at least one teacher per classroom for this program.
Mr. Chair, I was going to raise the issue. You'll be coming back to this program because of that issue, and also we use quite a bit of other fund balances last biennium to backfill this program. Mm-hmm. So we do have a funding hole of some amount depending on the fee structure, rate structure we use.
Okay.
So I'll move on to the Blind and Visually Impaired Student Fund, or known as BVIS. And this was established in 2009, which also closed the Oregon School for the Blind, and supporting helping move those students from the school to their local school district or other program that was appropriate for them.
I've still got the scars.
So there are five intended purposes for the fund: assisting those students to receive appropriate resources and services, supplementing funds to the regional programs. Remember, the blind disability is considered a low incidence disability, coordinating professional development around services for students, coordinating activities and providing technical assistance, and services are provided by a regional contractor. And the question came up earlier in my presentation about these students, and the Beavis Fund will continue to support the remaining. There are four remaining of the original group. There were 28 to begin with, and there are four remaining. And that was as of the end of 2015-16, and the last student is expected to exit the system in 2019. So based on previous spending patterns and the history, it may be that there will be a change to the other funds, a switch from $5 million down to $3 million, because we may not need to expend as much.
Senator Roblin.
So when we were having those conversations, one of the conversations was that we were going to see if we could get beds in Washington, because they continue to have that program. Did we do that, or did they all stay in Oregon?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, there have been a few students that have accessed services over the border in Washington. I'm not sure, whether maybe residential or other kinds, but yes, they have accessed services. So I move to the largest Individuals with Disabilities Act, the federal funds of $261 million. Again, it's supporting 76,000 plus students with disabilities who have IEP, and goes back to the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act that was passed in 1975. So primarily districts are responsible for a term that you might hear is child find. We need to locate, evaluate, and identify students with disabilities, and that's called child find. We then develop an individualized education plan with the family for the student, and then implement the program and comply with other federal regulations about IEP services. We provide annual allocations based on a federal formula to school districts in order to help support them in the provision of their special education-related services to these students. We were asked to make note of whether we expect any changes. The estimates for the IDEA funding for 17-18, we are in the midst of completing that application to the federal government, and the estimates are in line, with what we've received this year. And so there has been no indication, but similar to you, I've just been noticing whether 2018 there might be a change. Maintenance of effort, we've discussed a couple of times already this morning, and as I've mentioned, districts need to maintain from 1 year to the next the spending on services for students with disabilities. In addition, from 1 year to the next, the state must also. We use the same term, maintenance of effort, but there's actually different letters for what we do, but I'll just continue to call it state maintenance of effort. If a district does not maintain effort, they must repay the shortfall, but they cannot use federal funds. They have to use non-federal funds. If the state does not keep up with maintenance of effort, then there could be a potential of losing federal funds. The allocation or the grant application would be less. I don't know if I mentioned, but we talked about 2010-11 and the request back to the legislature in order to meet maintenance of effort back then, $13.8 million.
I remember that, and I remember we felt like we had to do it or we would get a double whammy because we would lose federal funds. So we scraped it up somewhere.
So just to let you know, the programs that are included in state-level maintenance of effort, calculation, and you can see the list there, our Department Operations for Special Ed, School for the Deaf, the Beavis Fund, et cetera. And so there's quite a long list that's a part of the state maintenance of effort.
Senator Roblin.
So when we sold the property, and that money went into a special fund for those students, is that continue to be part of our maintenance of effort? So we're going to have to come up with money even though this property is sold?
Senator Roblin, yes, it is considered, and so we keep an eye on that.
Okay, that's what I...
I will move to the last slide related to grant and aid for special education programs. And there are no reductions from current service level. As we've just talked about, we need to keep in mind the state maintenance of effort requirements, but there are no additional investments.
Thank you very much, Ms. Drinkwater, Mr. Knorr. That's going to do it for today. And we'll pick it up right here tomorrow. Are there questions, anything for the good of the order from members of the committee or from Mr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, just to set, we set public testimony, and it went to the system last night. So public testimony and early learning and grant, early learning and youth development will be next Wednesday, and on Thursday will be state school fund and K-12 issues. Now, generally, if we need more time, we'll add a day, it would be the next week. But I would hope we stipulate that people that come that third day, if required, had already signed up, so we don't keep opening the door continuously to public testimony.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
we'll
you.
See you tomorrow. We are adjourned.
Yeah, just
adjourned.
Yeah, just
tomorrow.